I'm Jesse Thorne. You're listening to The Turnaround, a show where I go deep with some of the greatest interviewers in the world about how and why they do what they do. It's a partnership between MaximumFun.org and the Columbia Journalism Review. Today, my guest is Katie Couric. Yes, America's sweetheart, the one who hosted the Today Show, the CBS Evening News. She's been on CNN. If there is a famous person in the world, especially a politician, Katie Couric has probably interviewed them. Everybody from Colin Powell to Hillary Clinton. In 2008, she did a segment with Sarah Palin. At the time, she was the Republican vice presidential candidate here in the United States on CBS, and it earned her a Walter Cronkite Award. Here's a little bit of it.
You've cited Alaska's proximity to Russia as part of your foreign policy experience. What did you mean by that?
That Alaska has a very narrow maritime border between a foreign country, Russia, and on our other side, the land boundary that we have with Canada. It's funny that a comment like that was kind of made to, reporters.
Mocked.
Yeah, mocked, I guess that's the word, yeah.
Well, explain to me why that enhances your foreign policy credentials.
Well, it certainly does, because our next-door neighbors are foreign countries. They're in the state that I am the executive of.
And she also interviews, like, Julia Roberts. She's really good at that, too. Katie Couric on The Turnaround. Let's get into it. Katie Couric, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you, Jesse. Nice to be here and to talk to you.
I was glad to hear about the dollar slices of pizza that are available right at the door.
You're
of,
not supposed to discuss our pre-show chats, Jesse. That was
that's a kind of pro tip that I came to you for.
Okay,
Katie Couric.
Well, it's true. There's a pizza joint right next to the building where I do my podcast, and they have $1 slice of pizza. So it's always kind of too hard to resist because it smells so good. It wafts through the streets of Manhattan. So I always duck in there and grab a slice. And my friend Allison is with me today doing – I should have brought pizza for everybody, actually. Now I feel really badly. I'm looking for looking at three people who look hungry through a glass pane. They look hungry and sad that I didn't bring the pizza. So maybe next time, kids, next time.
Okay, so you've had every kind of broadcast journalism job, but I want to start with morning news because it is the thing that when I see it on television, I am most – it is the thing that I feel least like I could do that.
Really?
Like I can read a teleprompter. I can write some copy, but – the parade, like the to do 12 things in one morning is profoundly daunting to me. So when you went from being a reporter to being in the anchor chair on a morning news show, what was that like for you?
Well, it was very exciting because I'm a real generalist. I always say that I'm 5 miles wide and half an inch deep. I'm very interested in a lot of different topics. And for me, morning television, when I was at the Today Show, really kind of fed all those different curiosities. And so one morning, of course, you know, there were mornings where we had very intense, super serious news stories to cover. And there were other mornings where you got a real smorgasbord of content. So it was a lot of fun for me. It was pretty daunting to occupy a seat on a show that was such an institution and had such a rich history and was really a part of people's daily routine. And you know, it was a very big stage and a lot of pressure, but I remember sort of feeling like, you know, I'm just going to be who I am and let the chips fall where they may, because I think even back then, before authenticity became such a, you know, a buzzword, I think people responded to someone who seemed to be their authentic self on television.
Well, it seems like it would be hard to fake it for that long every day.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a long time to be on TV being phony.
You know what I mean? Yeah, no, you're right. But I also think, you know, If I didn't know something, I didn't pretend like I knew it. If I wasn't super expert on sports and I was sitting next to Bryant Gumbel, one of the most knowledgeable people on the planet when it comes to sports, I wouldn't pretend like I did. I would just sort of, you know, act like, what? Which was, I think, people responded to, because I think a lot of people in the audience probably were not as obsessed with sports as Bryant was. And, you know, you have a lot of down moments in morning television where people do get to know you. I know people used to come up to me all the time and say, I feel like I know you. And I'd say, well, you kind of do. You've seen me in serious news situations. You've seen me in lighter moments. I've had to share personal experiences, like when my husband died, or, you know, my daughters were both born when I was the co-anchor of the Today Show. My sister passed away from pancreatic cancer. And so, you know, people do get to know you. And it was always kind of a balancing act. You want people to feel as if they know you, and you want to have an intimate relationship, but you don't want it to be too intimate. You don't want to be TMI all the time and talking about yourself all the time. So it was always this kind of delicate balance for me.
How long were you there in the morning before you went on air?
Not nearly as long as you might expect. you know, I'm sort of a wing it type person, a big procrastinator. So I remember when I started, I'd get up at 4:15 and, you know, wander bleary eyed to the 30 Rock. And then as the years progressed, I kind of got there later and later. I ended up sort of getting up at, I don't know, 6:15. And I think in a weird way, the adrenaline woke me up, and, you know, it would be a mad dash to get ready and to get briefed. And a lot of the segments I would have looked at the night before, if there was an author on or if there was a movie star hawking a movie, then I'd already seen the movie. And so it was really just sort of the overnight news that I had to get brought up to speed on before the show. But, you know, some people, Matt is super meticulous, and I know he gets there at the same time, like every morning, like 4:37 or something like that. And I would just kind of rush in like a whirling dervish and kind of, and it became kind of a joke around the Today Show. People would look at their watches and be like, is she coming in today?
How carefully planned is a live interview on morning television? Do you have a segment producer who already knows what the shape of it will be every time?
Yeah, well,
or
you know,
is that something you're doing, you know, in the stream of things?
It's a little bit of both. I think you know, are prepared. You understand the subject matter. I always, when I'm doing an interview, kind of visualize or think about what the response will be, so I can come up with an appropriate follow-up question kind of beforehand, just because you just kind of want to be on your – bring your A game and know kind of the direction of the interview. Plus, you know, it's a very truncated period of time. Sometimes you have, gosh, 4 or 5 minutes now seems like a luxury because it's gotten increasingly shorter as time has gone on. But, you know, you have to get – the maximum amount of information to an audience in a very short period of time. So I think you want it as choreographed as possible beforehand, with the possibility of it taking on a life of its own or changing direction mid-course.
What's a time that you were doing one of those five-minute interviews and you got something that was so unexpected that it completely redirected the final 3 minutes or whatever?
I mean, I've done so many different interviews throughout the course of my career. I mean, I guess this, the one that comes to mind is probably when I interviewed Sarah Palin and we were walking and I asked her about what sort of magazines and newspapers she regularly reads or read that helped establish her worldview before she was tapped. I was interested in exploring how people become so ideologically entrenched in a point of view and what has shaped that point of view, whether it was William F. Buckley or even the Bible or what it was that kind of made her adopt a certain political ideology. And, you know, that got a lot of attention, that question and her response, because I think, honestly, she was just sort of sick of me and had had it with me and kind of was like trying to brush me off. But I think, you know, that was not an anticipated answer. And I tried to push her a little bit and to get specific about if she could name a newspaper or magazine that she felt had shaped her worldview. And I think her annoyance made people think that it was less that she was annoyed with me but couldn't answer the question properly. I think she could have. I just don't know why to this day she chose to answer the way she did. But, I mean, I can think of countless times where I've, you know, had to listen and then take an interview in a different direction. You know, it just it happened on a regular basis, too numerous for me to even articulate right now.
What can you ask a movie star that will guarantee the kind of – there has to be a certain intensity on morning television particularly, a certain kind of vibrancy. How do you get that when they've literally just sat down in front of you?
Well, I think that, you know, it's I think people can sense a genuine interest and curiosity from the interviewer. I know when I'm talking to someone, I want them to feel, and I feel, that they're the only person on planet Earth in that moment in time, that I am completely locked in to them, what they want to talk about, what they're interested in, and that I approach them with respectful curiosity, you know, that I'm genuinely interested in what they have to say. And I really work hard to not ask every question they've been asked at some entertainment junket, you know, I try to ask questions that are thoughtful, that will be illuminating, that will reveal something about themselves that maybe they wouldn't have revealed normally. You know, I put a lot of thought into the conversation I have with people, but I think the key is that no matter who it is, whether it's an actor or a writer or a politician, you know, a CEO, that I know sort of what they're interested in and that I key into that. Of course, with politicians or somebody who's in – I think every interview requires a different kind of tone and a different skill set because the goal is different. You know, the goal of talking to a movie star is different than the goal you might have holding a politician's feet to the fire. So I think you kind of have to – get into the right headspace before you sit down with these people to get the most out of the interview, if that makes sense.
It seems to me like, I mean, as a guy who does, for my show, when I'm interviewing somebody, I get an hour. We'll probably cut that to half of that eventually. I can risk the possibility that I'm going down a blind alley and I'm going to come up against a chain link fence.
Mm-hmm.
When you're on live television, especially when you're on live television that, you know, in a situation where you have 4 minutes or 7 minutes, you're really taking a risk anytime you ask a question that you don't know the answer to.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you also have to think about how open-ended are the questions. You know, I think the empathy that allows you to be a good interviewer is also the empathy that's required when preparing for a good interview. You have to kind of put yourself in that person's shoes and sort of think about what the response might be. And so I think, you know, once you have a little bit of experience, you know, sort of overly broad, open-ended, uber philosophical question that's going to require a lot of, you know, explanation or and you try to avoid those and try to think of something that you can more narrowly broach or target. But, you know, there are a lot of tricks too. You can politely interrupt somebody and move on. I mean, a lot of this is sort of a delicate verbal dance that you have to do with people. And you know, some of the tricks of the trade are like, you know, you kind of, you can urge people on. I used to tell people when they sat down, hey, if you see me with my finger kind of giving you a rap, that means you need to speed it up or we're almost out of time, because that's helpful to people because they don't want to be cut off mid-sentence either, right? They want to get out what they want to say. So there are a lot of kind of, I think, visual and verbal cues you can employ that help move an interview subject along. And just, you know, just pitfalls that you don't want to ask questions that require long, expansive answers. And, of course, you want to avoid those yes or no questions. That's kind of journalism 101.
What are the physical things that you do besides going mm-hmm, or giving somebody the wrap it up sign?
I think, you know, I mean, I think if somebody is sort of has a high emotional intelligence, I think they can, you can do a lot with your eyes. You can kind of urge them on, or you can kind of look at your paper, and that's kind of a visual cue that maybe they're losing you a little bit or you're going to move on to a different topic. You know, some are subtle and some aren't so subtle, like, you know, acting like I'm hanging myself in the middle of a question, but you know, putting on a noose and hopefully off camera.
Katie, I'm hoping that I'm interrupting you in the correct, polite manner. But in what context did you give yourself?
I'm totally kidding. And I don't really do the noose thing. But I do the kind of let's wrap it up. So I you know, it's really hard to explain. If you were sitting across from me, Jesse, I think I could sort of show you. And I think it's harder, obviously, in something that's not a visual medium. I mean, we're talking on a podcast. So I think for us, you know, your cue might be, well, wait, can I go back? Or wait, Katie, wait, can you explain that to me? Or that reminds me of another question I have, you know, so you can do it. So it's not impolite, but it kind of moves things forward. And some of it is just kind of second nature. It's really about being a good conversationalist. I mean, the same tricks that you employ at a cocktail party, you know, you basically employ in an interview situation. That means you listen to people, you find them interesting, even if they're not. And I remember Johnny Carson told this story about being famous, and he said, you know, the great best thing about being famous, and I'm paraphrasing it, but is that people can come up to you at a cocktail party. You could have absolutely nothing to say, and they walk away thinking they're boring, which I thought was sort of funny. But anyway.
Right now I'm picturing you at a cocktail party chatting with somebody and then giving them the wrap it up signal.
I don't see. This is the wrap it up signal at a cocktail party. Oh, excuse me. I'm just going to go freshen my drink. Or, excuse me, I'm going to freshen my drink. Why don't you two introduce yourselves to each other? That's really handy if you can't remember anybody's name, which I do all the time. You know, because people think that I remember everybody, but I've met probably, you know, I don't know, a million people in the course of my career. Who knows? And I always, when I ever approach someone, I always say, hi, so-and-so, it's Katie Couric. How are you? Because sometimes people, you know, out of context, it's hard for people to realize who someone is. And I think that's a really important thing. People should do that to help people out.
I am so terrified of that. Like, I am so awful at remembering people's names. And I just I am just floating through the world with
that
70% of my mind on the conversation, 30% of my mind in like a terrified loop trying to remember what the person I'm talking to's name is.
I
could be talking to my child and be in this situation.
Well, that's not good. But
which uncle is this? I'm thinking to myself as I talk to an uncle.
Oh, that's funny. Well, you know, sometimes I think honesty is the best policy. You just say, I am so sorry. I just had a complete brain synapse misfiring. I can't remember your name. I'm so embarrassed. Sometimes you can get away with that. Other times you just have to kind of wing it and do, I'm going to freshen my drink. Why don't you two introduce yourselves?
Katie, I am really glad that you, Network Television's Katie Couric, have a very classy way of saying brain fart. which is brain synapse misfiring.
I just hate that F word. I really do. And I try to avoid it. Although I have to say I do use it privately, Jesse. I don't say brain synapse misfiring and, you know, when I'm with among friends.
My friend and colleague Dave Shumka grew up in a no-swearing household where he was not allowed to say the word fart. And instead, in his household, the word fart was referred to as F word for dirts.
Oh, really? F? Wait.
F word for dirts. D-I-R-T-S. Dirts was what they called farts. And
dirts.
F word for dirts was how they
referred
to the word farts.
Oh, I get it. We called them boos. Did you boo? And then my late husband's family called it bunt. Did you bunt? Which I thought was kind of a nice word for it. But I don't know that the F word, I don't know. It's very onomatopoetic, isn't it? Because it does sound the way it sounds, fart.
It's toots in my house.
I like that, too. That's kind of a sweet, sanitized version, isn't it?
It's whimsical.
It is. And as if it's musical.
So when you went from, and you know, you had been substitute anchoring the news and doing some field reporting on and off throughout your morning television career, but when you switched to doing that full time, was it a challenge to re-engage the style of conversation that is necessary to do a great conversation that is not live, a situation where you might have half an hour or 45 minutes and that will generate a 5 or 10 minute piece?
Oh, yeah. It's impossible. I mean, you're talking about doing an evening newscast versus a 2 hour morning show.
Yeah. Or even doing
a long sit down
field
interview.
Piece for Dateline or whatever.
Yeah.
Rather than a morning show thing.
It is hard because it is it is time to the second. You have 22 minutes with, when you take away the commercials to do all the news that's fit to broadcast. And, you know, usually if you have a question or two, you know, they're very carefully choreographed and scripted. And I think it always felt a little stilted for me because I couldn't kind of do what I think I'm good at, which is really engaging people, really kind of going at things a bit deeper, kind of letting a conversation flow and be spontaneous because you just didn't have the luxury of time. So that was definitely one of the challenges of the job.
When you're field reporting or doing a feature interview in the field, like, you know, when you are walking with Sarah Palin, or you've interviewed over 75 presidents, any of those, you know, where you get
an
hour.
I'm not that old.
Maybe, or half an hour, and that's going to get boiled down. You have to develop this thing where, you know, it's a very different kind of conversation that is, in part, less about that convivial and spontaneous exchange and more about a search for
truth.
Moments.
Yeah. Or, yeah, like, but also truth, but yes.
That's
something
fair. I mean, especially with politicians, you know, part of what you're trying to do is just get anything that isn't talking points.
Right.
But like, you're looking for, you know, when you're doing a field piece, you're looking for that 15 or 20 second moment that fits into the narrative so that you can build your narration around it and get to the next great moment. And that's a very different thing than an extended spontaneous conversation. I mean, it might come out of a spontaneous conversation, but you have to always have a sort of third eye looking for those high points.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I don't approach it quite that intentionally. You know, to me, it's about learning something, having someone illuminate a topic or talk honestly about something. It's also about how is this being communicated to the people who are watching it? You know, what are they learning from this encounter? What are they learning about this person? What are they learning about this topic? What are they learning that's going to affect their daily lives or make them smile or make them think? So it's less like, oh, what is the moment for me? A moment generally comes in a engaged in an interesting conversation, but it's not what I kind of look for necessarily when I'm doing an interview.
That's interesting. Do you have that sort of third eye on yourself as you're doing it? I mean, are you producing in your head as
yeah,
you're
definitely.
Conversing with your mouth?
Definitely. I mean, I definitely have – I don't have a third eye. I probably just have very, very adept ears because I hear a sound bite or I hear something that I think was surprising or interesting or intimate or revealing or whatever, and I think, oh, that was a really interesting thing that person just said. And I think, oh, we got to make sure we use that, right, when you're making these difficult choices in the editing process. So I'm very conscious of I guess, what you would refer to as moments. I'm very conscious of when someone says something that I think is interesting, but not only I think is interesting, but that I think other people would find interesting. You know, honestly, I just really do consider myself a vessel for other people's curiosity. I want to ask what people at home are asking if I don't understand something, and I think perhaps it's unclear to anybody else watching. I want to, you know, dig deeper to get more of an explanation, but I really try to do it in the service of the listener or the viewer, and that's why I try to channel questions that I think, you know, that people watching will want to know the answer to. I think sometimes journalists really produce content for other journalists, and they're kind of in this competitive news-making game. And I think it's important for someone to say something new and different, but, you know, how much does it, again, serve the audience? That's what is always first and foremost on my mind.
We'll have more of my conversation with Katie Couric after this, but first let's hear about some of the other shows that MaximumFun.org produces that you might want to check out.
Creativity, comedy, and friendship. All these things and more are waiting for you at Max FunCon East at the maybe haunted Pocono Manor, September 1st through 3rd. We only have a few tickets left, and they're on sale right now. So head on over to MaxFunCon.com to buy your tickets. Don't miss out.
From the dawn of time, one podcast has unlocked the secrets of science and technology to enrich the lives of billions. And now, after a year where they've unlocked the golden age of knowledge, they're about to hit warp speed and go stratospheric.
Wait, hold up.
On Oh No, Ross and Carrie, we don't make extraordinary claims. We investigate them.
We go undercover with fringe religious groups, investigate paranormal claims, and we participate in pseudoscientific medical treatments and then report our findings to you.
And yes, we've even investigated Scientology.
Shh, Ross, shh. New episodes every month at MaximumFun.org.
Oh No, Ross and Carrie. They show up so you don't have to.
We're back. I'm talking to Katie Couric. Let's get back to my conversation. You talk to people who are incredibly skilled and practiced speakers a squajillion times.
Uh-huh.
So you've talked to every politician at the highest levels. You've talked to every movie star at the highest levels. How do you get them to engage you on a human level, on the intimate level that you described? When they are the most practiced speaker in the world, when they could just put on a little 5-minute show for you and it would be fine?
I think because I try to ask questions that they haven't heard a million times before, knowing that there's some baseline questions that you can't avoid. But I try to engage them in a way that makes them feel more like they're more than a movie star hawking a movie or, you know, they're on a junket. And, you know, I've had enough experience being interviewed myself for certain, you know, different projects by multiple people that I get super bored to answering the same questions. And I always want to make up things like, you know, my parents were missionaries and I grew up in, you know, Zambia, you know, all sorts of weird things just because I get so tired saying the same thing over and over again. And I think an acknowledgement of that and going in knowing that they don't want to be asked the same pedestrian questions for the 85th time, you know, whether I ask it differently or I have a different kind of take on something, I think that really is effective at cutting through.
How do you get there? How do you get to a question that – I mean, do you look at what they've been asked and think about what the next thing is? Do you look at what they've asked and think about what the most different thing you can think of is? How do you, like, practically achieve something that haven't heard before?
I can't say I review every interview they've done. But I don't know. And this sounds so pretentious and cheesy. But, I kind of try to search for essential truths. Like if I'm talking to Burt Reynolds about a movie, I talk to him about what it's like to get old. And, he did a movie about an older guy that I thought was really well done and really well acted. And, I try to talk to him about real shit, basically, and not in platitudes, but just something that I think will resonate with him. And, I think, again, it gets back to being genuinely interested in somebody and not phoning it in and not kind of going to the most predictable question. And I think, I think if I'm good at that, good at talking to people, it's because that you can't fake that. I am genuinely interested in almost everyone, and I really feel like everyone has something to say. And so I don't know. It's like there's no blueprint. It's very, it's one of those intangible things. You kind of either have it or you don't, right? This ability to connect with people in a very real and true way.
Are you embarrassed to ask anything of people?
Yeah. I mean, there's some lines I won't cross, some personal things that I won't ask. So, yeah, on a case-by-case basis, there are times where I won't go there. Especially if sort of an understood agreement but that usually doesn't happen. But yeah, I am embarrassed to ask people some questions, and I think there's a way to ask uncomfortable questions in a respectful way. I just did a documentary on transgender individuals, and I knew there was a lot of misinformation, ignorance among the general population, including me, about gender identity issues, the science, how someone, I asked an older couple, and they were just so nice, Kate and Linda Rohr, and Kate Rohr had gender confirmation surgery when she was 70 years old. And I talked to them a little bit about sex, how does that work? Does Linda, you're still in love with Kate, and yet you consider yourself a heterosexual woman, do you think of yourself as a lesbian now? Like, help me understand this. That was kind of potentially a really awkward exchange. But I knew going in, they had a willingness to talk openly and honestly about this, that they knew I was coming from a good place of seeking to understand myself and help other people gain greater understanding. So in that situation, It was okay. It was appropriate. Now, there are other settings where I never in a million years would ask questions like that. So, I think it just really depends on what's going on. And, sometimes I do say to people, I'd like to ask you about blank. Would you feel comfortable with that? Sometimes they'll say, no, I don't want to go there. And sometimes they'll be like, sure. And they'll appreciate the heads up. It's so hard, I think, for me at this point in my career, and I'm so sick of being called a veteran journalist. I'm like, stop calling me a veteran journalist. But, I've done so many interviews, and it's very hard to generalize because each one has a very specific outcome and tone. And, when I interviewed David Duke and asked him about some of the comments he had made about Jews, that's a very different interview than if I'm interviewing someone who lost a loved one on 9/11. I mean, everything, there's an appropriateness, an appropriate kind of intensity, And when you're really challenging somebody who you find morally repugnant and a very different intensity when you are there to help someone share their story that may be excruciatingly painful. So every human interaction in my professional life has required kind of a certain tonality that you need to be cognizant of going in and in the process of, if that makes sense.
It does. You know, just the other day, I was in a conversation with some fellow parents of trans kids who had watched your special about transgender people in America. And one of the things that someone said to me was, you know, it's a really nice thing because she comes in and she doesn't really know about transgender issues, and she's very open and comfortable with that and is willing to ask and listen. And that is a quality that I don't think is – I think asking and listening is endemic to journalists, but being open about what you don't know is not necessarily that journalism in part for a lot of people is about gathering as much information as you can so that you can have the information and essentially be a know-it-all.
Right.
And it can be difficult when that is your impulse to open yourself up to your own ignorance publicly.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Well, no, I appreciate that. And it is sort of, you know, it was truth, you know, so it wasn't feigned ignorance. And I think we could all use a little more humility. I think the older I get, the more I realize there's so much I don't know and so much I never will know. And I think a really helpful device for storytelling, if you want to say, in journalism in general, is to take people on that journey of learning, right? And if you're their proxy, which I've always tried to be my entire career, be very mindful of people listening. People, you know, the highest compliment someone can give me is, you always ask the question I want to ask, or I always have a question, and the next thing you know, you're asking that question that I have. That to me is just profoundly gratifying. And so I think that humility of saying, you know, this is new, this is different, this is kind of scary. I don't know how to deal with this because I don't understand it. I think it was in that case a really very effective way of bringing people along for the ride. I remember that during one of the screenings, I was kind of embarrassed about how ignorant I sounded because I had learned so much in the process of making the documentary, and I was much smarter just in the span of 6 months. And I remember saying to someone at the Human Rights Campaign who was with me and saw the documentary, I'm embarrassed. You know, I'm kind of embarrassed that I sounded so stupid. And she said, no, you know, for people to see you evolving is really the most effective way to communicate what you were trying to communicate. And I thought that was interesting. She said, you know, people appreciated where President Obama finally came out on gay marriage in terms of his position, and because they saw him wrestling with it and they saw him coming out the other side. I thought that was an interesting way of looking at things.
When I was talking with Larry King, one of the things that struck me about him, I mean, I don't know, I imagine you probably met Larry King at a gala banquet at some point.
I had a date with Larry King, Jesse.
What, like a romance date?
Well, I wouldn't say it was super romantic, but yes, it was a date.
Oh,
I'm
going to
save it
awesome.
For my book, man. I'm going to save it for my book.
Oh, give me a break. Oh, gee whiz. Okay.
Yeah.
I'll let you do it out of respect to you and your book contract.
Thank you.
But one of the things, oh, man, you're lucky I'm a pseudo journalist and not a real journalist because it's very difficult.
I've talked
not
about
to
it
just
before.
Pester
it's not
you.
That big a scoop, so don't be okay. too disappointed.
Okay. Well, the thing that I was going to say about old Larry is he – one of the things that was so remarkable to me about his work and, you know, like I watched a bunch of his stuff when I was preparing to talk to him was how comfortable he was asking a dumb question that was great, like something that revealed something that was so plain and simple, something that was so obvious, but also was like totally fascinating, like asking a bird what it's like to fly. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, of course we all want to know what it's like for a bird to fly. But you wouldn't ask that because you'd feel weird about it. But, yeah, he's just like, yeah, what's it like to fly, bird? And I think that requires a kind of almost foolhardy modesty to say, look, this is something that's worth being curious about. I'm just going to be curious about it and see how it goes.
Yeah, no, I admire Larry's technique and method. I mean, I think there's sort of a middle ground of being completely unprepared and open to ask any questions. No. And I think he would tell you that.
I
that
agree.
Was sort of his MO. Like, he wanted to know as little as people watching knew. But I sort of think there's that happy medium between that and having humility about your lack of expertise and preparing and understanding a topic so you get the best from your guest, if that makes sense. So that you can be discerning about the important aspects of a conversation that you think would be most beneficial to the viewer.
Particularly when you're talking to someone who is someone in the public square, a politician or something like that, where it requires expertise on your part in order to fully engage the conversation, translate the conversation, and if necessary, challenge someone.
Right, exactly. It's hard to come up with cogent follow-ups where you're exploring a subject more deeply if you haven't really prepared and schooled yourself on said subject, right?
You did 20 squidjillion interviews, and which of them were the ones that made your stomach turn? Was it presidents or movie stars or walking into a town and not knowing anyone and knowing you were going to have to bother people on the street or what?
The latter never bothered me because I'm the kind of person who could come up to anyone and start talking to them. I don't have a shy bone in my body. I would say for me, it was, I think when you're interviewing someone who has deep expertise in a topic, and there's just no way you're going to be able to compete with that expertise, but you are in a position of having to challenge that person, that is the kind of thing that would get my stomach in knots. Or someone who is particularly pugnacious, like Ross Perot, who sort of would be condescending and patronizing to me if I asked a question that was challenging. I remember he'd say, Katie, and kind of bark back at me that way. Or Yasser Arafat, who if I had to challenge would be like, who told you that? And, suddenly you're like, oh, shit, I have to come up with, like, how I came to that question, why I asked it. All this background on what motivated that question, and that's very hard because no matter how much you study, if you go through the FDA manual about pesticides when you're interviewing the head of the FDA, they are almost dollars to donuts. They're going to know more about a certain subject than you are. So it's how do you kind of push back when they can just basically bowl you over with their facts and information?
How do you push back when they can bowl you over with their facts and information, he said, carefully asking for an example?
I think you just have to, continue to challenge. A lot of times they won't answer a question. And, it took me a while to have the confidence to say, I'm sorry, Senator, but you just didn't answer my question. And just kind of call a spade, or go at it in a different kind of way until you finally give up. I had a very uncomfortable interview with Colin Powell once following, I think it was the anniversary of 9/11, and it was after the invasion of Iraq, and talking about sort of what was the rationale for invading Iraq and, sort of the Sunni-Shia divide, and if it was going to basically disintegrate into a civil war, and why is the United States doing that? If, you know, if you break it, you take it, which was a Colin Powell motto. And, you know, he was just getting increasingly angry at me. And I think it's because I was raising all the things that he was concerned about, to be honest with you. And he was seeing his own kind of questioning reflected back at him. And I adore Colin Powell. I think he's a great person and a great American. And I remember he got up and he said, "Miss Couric." And I thought, oh, God, he is pissed. And that was just very uncomfortable. I also asked, I remember asking Laura Bush about how she felt about Roe v. Wade and whether or not it should be overturned. And she said, you know, she thought that that the number of abortions should be reduced. And I said, that's not mutually exclusive. You know, do you believe Roe v. Wade should be overturned? She said, I think the number of abortions should be reduced. And I went at it another time. And she finally said, I don't think Roe v. Wade should be overturned. And, you know, this was before the inauguration for President Bush. And I know that he was angry and didn't think it was an appropriate question and let the president of NBC know that. And so basically, I kind of kept at her until she answered it. And now some people would say it was badgering and other people would say it was respectful inquisition.
Did you feel it was the latter?
I did. I mean, I thought that probably she could have closed the door by saying, you know, this is a policy matter, Katie, and I'm really not here to talk about that.
Right.
You know, and I think sometimes people open the door a little bit. And what can I say, Jesse? It just makes me want to push it open a little bit more.
Oh, you don't have to tell me. I'm still thinking about this date with Larry King. If this was not a professional podcast of professional advice, Katie.
Yeah.
Oh, boy. Boy, howdy. Okay, we're on to closing thoughts here.
Oh, we are? Okay.
Katie, yeah, because you've got to do your podcast.
That's true.
And I'm grateful that you took the time to do
this. No, it's fun to talk to you, and it's fun to think about these things, because I am sort of thinking about kind of writing a book, maybe just for my daughters, about my life experiences and all the different people I've met and the challenges I've faced. And so it's actually a very helpful exercise for me to think back on some of these encounters. And I think, oh, yeah, I forgot about that. I should write about that.
If you need a ghostwriter, I'm willing to put together a book proposal called My Date with Larry King.
My husband thinks I should call the book People I Hate. By America's Sweetheart. I don't think I'm going to do that. I promised my dad, who passed away a few years ago, who was a journalist himself, that if I ever wrote a book, that I would write it myself. And so I appreciate the offer, but it's a promise I made to my father.
Okay. Well, second book, follow-up book. Yeah. You didn't promise him anything about the follow-up book.
Yeah.
Katie, what do you ask people when you are freaked out or lose your train of thought or otherwise are lost and don't know what to ask?
Oh, God, isn't that awful? I mean, it happens to everybody. Sometimes I have these little moments of panic and I'm like, oh, no, where am I going? What is the next question? Because, you know, you want to be listening intensely to what the person's going to say. But, you know, what is the interviewer's worst enemy? It's that dead air, which I think is a shame, because thoughtful conversation doesn't happen seamlessly, right? There are pauses and moments to think and quiet reflection, but it's very hard to do that in an interview situation. So, you know, luckily at the last second I remember, or I ask a question that's totally random, but or isn't what I intended to ask, but somehow it works. So I don't have a go-to question when I have a brain fart, as you call it.
But I call it F-word for dearth.
It's the F-word for dearth. But I kind of really go back to listening and think, well, my brain is going to help me come up with a follow-up to what was just said. But what is your go-to question when you have you draw a blank?
It's one that I stole from, I believe it's Scott Simon, that he related in This American Life's comic book, which was, what did you think it was going to be like, and how it turned out to be like compare?
I love Scott Simon. That's so funny.
You can ask that about any god dang thing, and it works great.
Yeah, that's true.
I ask it all the time. All the time, Katie.
You could also say, what was your biggest disappointment about that? Or how did you feel when that happened? That's pretty general too, right?
Yeah, you're probably better at asking people how something felt when it happened than I am.
Yeah, you're trying to stay away. Sweetheart. You're supposed to stay away from how does it feel? How did it feel?
I work for National Public Radio. I'm supposed to stick exclusively to questions about birding taxonomy. That's in our handbook. Just keep it focused on birding. That's what the people want to hear.
I'll keep that in mind.
Well, Katie Couric, I'm very grateful to you for taking all this time. And
I hope it was mildly entertaining and / interesting. I don't know.
I hope it wasn't so boring that you started making stuff up.
No, I didn't start making
things up. As you already said that you do our conversation.
I wish I had done a little more thinking and a little more homework, Jesse, so I could have had more real-world examples.
Katie, how many times have you done an interview and then with a legend in your field, and then halfway through they go, you know, I do so many interviews, it really bores me.
I didn't say that.
Yeah, you sure did.
No, I said when I'm talking about a certain project, and it's the same question over and over again. But you had some good questions, Jesse. I wasn't bored.
Well, I wasn't bored
at all, and I made up nothing.
Well, thank you very much, Katie. I really appreciate it.
All right, good luck with everything, Jesse.
That was Katie Couric. Be sure to check out her podcast. It's called Katie Couric. She's talking with some of the biggest names in news, politics, and pop culture. Folks like Neil deGrasse Tyson and Julia Louis-Dreyfus. That's it for the turnaround this week. If you like the show, tell a friend. Subscribe, leave us a review in Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your shows. You can always visit MaximumFun.org to find this or any of our upcoming shows. The Turnaround is a production of Maximum Fun and the Columbia Journalism Review, CJR. CJR's mission is to encourage excellence in journalism in the service of a free society. You can learn more at CJR.org, where you can also find edited transcripts of all of our interviews, perfect for sharing on social media. They've got a great podcast, too. It's called The Kicker. All of The Turnaround's music is provided to us by Mobius Van Chalkstraw. You can check out his stuff at chopsmusic.com. The creator of The Turnaround is me, Jesse Thorne. Our producers are Kara Hart and Nick Liao. Senior producer at Maximum Fun is Laura Swisher. Our managing director, Bikram Chatterjee. Special thanks to Kyle Pope, Emily Erskine, and Daryl Frost. We'll talk to you next time on The Turnaround.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.